Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the beginning of October edition of Warrior Connection. This is Doug Rocky coming from the sunny but very cold area of Illinois. Tonight we're going to have another discussion continuing on. Professor Eckhart, are you with us by chance?
I am, Doug.
Good evening. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great, sir. And how is it over down there? Are you guys still cold, too, where we are?
Well, it's turning a little colder, and the paint is being splashed on the leaves of the trees, so it's a beautiful time of year.
Wow, yeah, we kind of, with the weather, everything changing, it was so dry here, I don't think we're going to see the beautiful fall colors that we've normally seen, but anyway, corn's getting out of the field, and they're going to start harvesting the beans, but boy, it got cold over the last few nights.
I'm on here, too, dear. It's Patricia Axelrod.
Well, fantastic.
How are you doing tonight, everybody?
Fine, Patricia. Good to hear you.
Good to hear you, too, sir.
You know, where I live here near Rantoul, Illinois, we're the home of the former home of Chanute Air Force Base. And Chanute Air Force Base is where the famed Tuskegee Airmen were founded. They were formed here at Chanute Air Force Base. The air crews obviously went down to Tuskegee, Alabama to learn how to fly. And all of the maintenance people stayed here, and they totally excelled in all education and everything they did. Some of the legends about the Tuskegee Airmen that stands here in our museum at the Chanute Air Museum, which we have talked about before on the show, is the fact that the Tuskegee Airmen, when they were going through education and military training, had the highest grade point average of any individuals ever achieved by anybody previous to that time, and their grade point average on how well they did their academics has never been equal to this day. That's an incredible testament to the incredible people that became the Tuskegee Airmen. Well, tonight, we want to move the clock forward, because at that time with the Tuskegee Airmen, obviously, education of blacks, African Americans, and colored, as they were called at that time, let's open up what the terms were, was prohibited. In fact, they couldn't be enrolled in public schools. They couldn't be enrolled in universities and everything else. Well, along in 1962, a gentleman by the name of James Meredith jumped in and said, hey, I want to go to the University of Mississippi. And he was eventually enrolled, and he eventually graduated. He went on to be an extraordinary contributions to our nation. And so, Professor Eckhart, you've got a lot of knowledge about this. This is what you wanted to talk about tonight to begin with. Could you fill us in on James Meredith, sir?
Yeah, can I just interject something here, sir? Before, for the benefit of those who weren't with us the last time Bill Eckhart was on our program, maybe you could give us a brief rundown as we speak of extraordinary people. Why don't we introduce our guest to our listeners?
Absolutely. Professor, can you give us a little bit of your background, sir?
Certainly. I am a regular Army colonel. I served for 30 years. The last time we were on, we talked about law of war. We talked a lot about My Lai, and we talked about things like that. But tonight, one of the things I thought would be interesting is when we talk about James Meredith and that, there were a whole bunch of heroes in a saga that what I call the Knight. And we don't talk very much about rebellion in the United States, and rebellion especially that revolves around this issue, but there are some incredible clashes that occurred probably one of the last times that we've had this sort of thing in the United States, and I thought it might, on the 50th anniversary James Meredith's entry into Ole Miss, might be worthwhile talking about that. And it's not very pleasant. We forget how quickly these sorts of things happen, and it's not just an integration story. It's a story basically of ending of the Civil War, of rebellion, and that sort of thing. And that's why I thought that might be of some interest to your listeners tonight, Doug.
Well, I think, you know, again, what we're talking about, Warrior Connection is a progressive radio network, education, information, and giving people something to think about. And, sir, go ahead and fill us in a little bit about James Meredith. I've read up a little bit about him. I mean, the gentleman, I mean, just had an extraordinary career even before going to the university. And then once he graduated.
Well, I thought I'd talk a little bit, Doug, about the preliminaries to him coming.
Sure, why don't you please do? It's all yours.
It's the heroes that paved the way for him that I think is the important thing. And I suppose I would start off a sort of a personal saga. Before he came to the university, there was a great deal of restive feeling, and it occurred on it started on a football field the week before. And the fans refused to stand for the national anthem. It was probably one of the most frightening nights I have ever witnessed. I thought for a while, to be blunt, that I was in Nuremberg.
And you were
the drum major, correct, sir?
Yeah. Right.
I was the drum major of the band, and that particular night, the high point of that night, or the low point, really, occurred in the halftime show, and I was on the field about 20 feet from the governor of the state, Ross Barnett.
It's the governor of the state of Mississippi.
The governor of the state of Mississippi.
Right in the middle of Mississippi.
Who went into an absolutely racial diatribe, and I simply moved the band off the field.
Leadership to take the entire University of Mississippi, Ole Miss, band off of the field as the governor went into his diatribe.
Well, yeah, I wasn't going to. Yes, and I, you know, as a twenty year old some odd lad, I'm not sure why I did it, but we just did it. Marched them off the field, and the band director came up to me later with tears in his eyes and just gave me this big hug. But it was a frightening night, Doug. But it the next week it got even worse. This is what I call the night of rebellion. The next night I was on my way to walking to my church group, and when I got to the central building on the University of Mississippi campus, the Lyceum, I saw quite a spectacle because in front of me was a platoon of armed military policemen. There were a whole bunch of federal marshals. There was an angry crowd. And of all people, when I walked up and we just sort of stood watching this with my mouth open, the chancellor of the university, John D. Williams, walked up, and we were standing there together with some amazement as the bottle started to fly, and we knew that it was not going to be a particularly pleasant evening, and indeed it wasn't. The issue was, I suppose, who was going to conduct law and order. And the Department of Justice, and this is one of the heroes of the night, Katzenbach, was the head of the Civil Rights Division, and he was there in command, really.
Under
Kennedy. Robert Kennedy was certainly the Attorney General, and then, of course, President Kennedy was the president. And they decided they would not use the military policemen because I suppose they didn't want military force, so they used the marshals, who were totally untrained for the job. And what turned out to be a tragedy for the night is the first shot fired in the night was by one of these untrained marshals, and it hit a Mississippi Highway Patrolman in the back.
Mm.
And when that happened, all of the security surrounding the left, they just said, "The heck with this." And then we had what I would call battle royal. By the time some hour and a half later I had left my church meeting and was walking back, we came upon the Confederate monument. And as the discussion, at least, that I heard on at length on NPR this week talking about this, on the monument you had two people. It's the most amazing sight I ever saw. You had Major General Walker, who was John Bircher leading the rebellion. And on the other side of the monument, standing up about 4 feet, as these monuments, Confederate monuments are, was the Episcopal priest in town. And there was a fairly large crowd surrounding, listening to these two men. And apparently the Episcopal priest began to get the better of the Major General. So the Major General grabbed the Episcopal priest by the lapels and threw him to the ground. Well, that was too much for most of the crowd. So they began to leave. But that began to tell you what was going to happen. So within an hour or so, you could hear the tear gas was rising, shots were being fired, and the marshals were in serious trouble. And the hero now, in this particular instance, it was the Episcopal priest before. Now it becomes William Faulkner's brother and people like him who were the National Guard people in town. And it became their task to keep these federal marshals supplied so that they didn't run out of ammunition. And so they kept driving army trucks to resupply them. Well, when they did this, the mob would throw huge pieces of concrete through the windows of the truck, et cetera. And so before it was all over, William Faulkner's brother had his arms broken and everything else as they frantically did everything they could to help the federal marshals. And in my judgment, they are heroes. The next morning, when I got up, I was a cadet colonel of the ROTC unit, so I went up to do my little PT formation, just routine. And when I got up to the top of the hill and looked at the field that we used, I gasped because the entire 101st Airborne Division was there, tents lined up, ready to go.
The 101st.
The 101st. What you had happen?
That's like sending the best of the best at that time.
Well, we had rebellion, and President Kennedy did several things very quickly. First, he federalized the Mississippi and the Alabama National Guard so that they would be under his control, and then not under Ross Barnett's control and others. That was essential. And then he put about a sixth of the standing army in Oxford, Mississippi, overnight. He declared curfew. We had the military control of the entire area. He just simply had to do it, and they came in quite quickly during the night of the evening that I'm describing. Many of us who were absolutely determined not to let the people who were causing the disruption to stop anything, we decided to continue class, to go to class, to do that sort of thing. So as I was walking to class, I met, tear gas was going, I was crying, and I looked over and there's this soldier about 30 feet from me, and he looks up to me and he says, "Bill," and I looked at him and I said, "Howard," because he was one of my high school buddies. And then he told me about his night, and this story tells you how you know the Civil War is over. He said that the night before he'd gotten the call that he had been federalized, so he was in his room packing his gear, and this did not please his family at all. So when he went out, his grandpappy, as he said, was sitting in the chair, and the entire family was standing around him in total silence, just staring at him. So he went over and he knelt down in front of his grandpappy and he said, "Granddad, I'm going. They've called me. I'm going. I know you don't like it, but I'm going." And so he stood up with absolute shunned silence and the rest of the family and walked out the door. A night that he would remember for the rest of his life. And when I heard that story, I said, "Jiminy crickets, Howard, good for you. The Civil War is over."
And the end result of this is a young man by the name of James Meredith.
Integrated
University of Mississippi, exactly. Go on, dear.
We had Army of Occupation for a while. The marshals did not do a particularly sterling job, but they held it. But there were incidents that occurred afterward, even then, as and I would call here heroes of people who, this time, federal officers who kept their cool. Meredith was in a particular dormitory up by that football field where I gave PT, and about 4 weeks later, when we were doing PT up there, we did this, and he had his security detail that was fairly extensive around that particular building. And all of a sudden, this airplane came over and started dipping down, and it was clearly in that area, and it shouldn't have been, and it kept going there. And all of a sudden, from out of the woods came this lieutenant. and he put this white glove on, and he raised the white glove in the air. And you knew what was going to happen. When that glove came down, the airplane was coming out of the air. And so the plane circled and circled and circled, and the glove was still up in the air, and we were all, finally, we were running on a mile run. We just stopped. I mean, you couldn't help but just stop and just stare. So all of a sudden, this plane sort of lowered his rear part of the plane, and a whole bunch of paper fell out, and he flew off. And so we all went over to see what the paper was, and it was some LSU football rivalry saying, you know, go to hell, Ole Miss, LSU. Well, that plane had no idea how close he came to being shot out of the air.
Yeah.
And the lieutenant, with his coolness, who was doing exactly what he had to do, but kept his restraint. And then I guess, Doug, the last thing I'd like to say is I want to compliment President Kennedy. When this happened, one of the most articulate speeches I think the president ever gave. And what he did was he spent, it was a 30-minute talk, and he spent the first part of it praising those who had fought so hard for civil rights and integration in the state, because he knew that we were the ones that were going to be hurt the worst fast. So he did that, and then he announced what he was going to do with the use of force, et cetera. That was a wonderful, wonderful way to handle that. But the last thing I would say as I sort of leave this is that he was not bashful. When you deal with rebellion, and he wasn't sure how extensive it was or how far it was going to be, he had the major general arrested. And without telling his defense counsel or anybody else where he was, he put him in an insane asylum in Texas, kept him there incognito for about 3 weeks until he was sure there was no rebellion, and then they released him.
That's interesting. They put him in an insane asylum. You mean they put him, they incarcerated him, huh?
They absolutely. No habeas corpus. They just put him away.
Huh.
Dealing firmly, just like Abraham Lincoln had to do with things. But I thought that on the 50th anniversary of James Meredith and what he did, there were a lot of people who paved that path and did it well. And I just thought that remembering sometimes what I call the night of rebellion might be of some interest, is also it's a tribute to, I think, many people who had to rise to the occasion when things happened. You know, the churches, you know, just we forget about this sort of thing. In the weeks that were surrounding this, particularly the Episcopalians and the Presbyterians, they just thundered from the pulpit. Thundered. You know, we don't see that sort of state-church clash very often, mm-hmm. or clash of values very often, but boy, there it was there. And if you think that people didn't have a problem, the minister that had the problem was the poor Methodist minister, who within 3 minutes after he finished his sermon and pronounced the benediction, the governor would be on the phone just putting pressure on him like you just would not believe. I just amazing.
When I look back, and as you mentioned, as preparing for this, and I went back to review what had happened on this stuff, I mean, that violent clash that you talk about, again, you can confirm or whatever happened. It said that two people died. One was a French journalist. In addition, he was shot in the back. There were 160 U.S. Marshals. One-third of the group were injured. 40 soldiers and National Guard were wounded. I mean, it sounded like it was just an all-out battle.
There's no other word to describe it. And what happened is, of course, is when that first misfire from the marshal and the highway patrolman whose loyalty was conflicted to begin with, but who were going to do their professional duty until that shot was fired, then they just left.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happened, anybody with a rifle and a hunting dog could come in and shoot away. And that's exactly what happened. and it was absolutely terrifying.
And how did you feel? I mean, from what we talked before, again, in your background, your parents were involved in the civil rights education issues and everything else, as you had explained to me before. And then here you are, you're in the Army ROTC, you're just, again, the commander of the unit for the ROTC as a cadet commander. You're run doing the band. How did you feel that evening? I mean, what was your thoughts, your upbringing, and how was that, how you felt then, and how do you feel today about all of this?
Well,
it's a difficult question. You understand what I'm trying to ask?
I guess the best way to answer you, Doug, is exactly what I did. After I left the monument down there with the Episcopal priest on the ground, I went up fairly distance to the ROTC building because I wanted to be sure the weapons were secured. And when I did that, this is on a very high hill, and you could sit down and just sort of overlook all of this. So I overlooked this, and you could hear the noise of battle and the tear gas going up. And I just sat there and wept. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. When you're involved in these sorts of things, you know, these are your people too. You know, you're just caught right in the middle, and you have to make choices and you have to do things. But it looks so sterile 50 years later when you look at it and you say, oh, it's obvious that would happen. Oh, it's obvious that this should happen. Well, you know, when those things are going on around you, it's not so obvious, and that's why I think there's so many heroes involved in this, from the Howard Connors who left from his grandfather to the Episcopal priest who stood to and let's don't forget poor Mr. Katzenbach, who's sitting in there. And the rumor is that, you know, he was probably one of the most outstanding members in the Department of Justice, particularly in the civil rights area the United States has ever had. And what's he doing? He's sitting in there doing his. He comes out and he gives clear directions, and then he goes back into the room he's sitting in, and he's so upset that he just simply barfs in a waste basket for 20 or 30 minutes until he can get his pull himself together again, and then go back and do these sorts of things. That's life. That's what I think happens when these events break around you. And so that was the night that I just think sometimes when we think about Meredith and we think about the progress that the University of Mississippi has made, the progress that the state's made, I just think we ought to recall some of these heroes. I said one time they were my people. Summer right after that, we were all so horrified by this that we were in an elevator in the Capitol. And one of my friends was running the elevator, and Martin Luther King got on, and somebody said something about Mississippi, and my friend was embarrassed and made some disparaging comment about Mississippi, whereupon Martin Luther King turned around, put his finger in his face, and says, "Don't you say that." He said, because in the not-too-distant future, if you want to know where the best place to be for a black person, it's going to be in Mississippi, and don't forget it. And he walked off the elevator. So you see change all around you when you have these sorts of things, and you see progress. I mean, if you wanted to see progress, when I was in the military, Doug, as we were talking about, I'd come back from Europe or come back other places, and if you're going to do that sort of thing, you have to have some idea of what's going on in your own country. And I used to go over to a sister's campus, and I just watch. And what I watched was 10, 15 years later, black and white students together. They all, nobody had any money. They were all poor as church mice, but they, by George, they were in clean jeans, and they were going to class, this was their chance to rise above poverty. And the way they could rise above poverty is with education, and they were using every minute of it. And you just wanted to cheer.
Mm-hmm.
And my platoon sergeant when I was in the Army was at Jackson State when all that happened, and he rose above that, and, you know, he was just an incredible, incredible individual. I mean, he came out of that era, you know, three, four years later, but just incredible things that happened. I think, which is, as I'm reading through here and preparing for this, James Meredith obviously graduated from the University of Mississippi.
He did.
He went on to get a law degree from Columbia University.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's astonishing.
Well,
I mean, did he have, at that time, did he have any problems? Do you know, have any problems getting into Columbia? Or because of the early results when he got into the University of Mississippi, did this open this up to where he could get his law degree at Columbia? Or how'd that work out?
I just don't know, Doug. He
well,
was
Columbia's in New York, though, New York City.
Yeah.
And that's a different scenario than the University of Mississippi.
Well, he was a rock star by that time for the civil rights cause. And what he did, his courage paved the way for others who came and went forward. And I think that's the important thing. But
here's an interesting footnote to this, though, is that James Meredith, when interviewed about this just this past week, sadly feels that this nation is still subject to extraordinary racism. And so although obviously we've made tremendous growth in this area, it's also very apparent that this is still something that means that we're not colorblind. Despite the dreams of Martin Luther King, we're still not colorblind. And I don't know if that time will ever come.
I think the other thing was totally astonishing, as I read about Meredith's career, he literally served as a domestic advisor on the staff of U.S. Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina. That is an astonishing, astonishing move for James Meredith and Jesse Helms to come together for so long. I mean, it's just, it boggles the mind.
That is an interesting Billy do to it all, I've got to say that. Well, Bill, this all led you to the yet another footnote, more than a footnote, but a very historical time, and that, of course, is, for those who don't know, our guest here was the chief prosecutor at the My Lai trial in Vietnam and was responsible for attempting to bring justice in that arena as well. And maybe you could very briefly tell us about that. And if we could, I sure would like to talk about military justice and what's going on in Afghanistan, for instance. But first, if you could briefly fill in for the benefit of those who were not listening last time you were on, can you just tell us very briefly about My Lai?
Certainly. My Lai was an incident that occurred in Vietnam in 1968. There was a village that American soldiers thought they were going to receive enemy fire. They did not. As a result, there were some 500-plus casualties in this particular village. It occurred in a couple of hours, and the issue, there were trials that lasted for some years attempting to hold people accountable for that, basically the United States saying we can't tolerate that sort of conduct. And that's basic, and it is sort of a cause célèbre, whether it for a long time, and perhaps many people think it's when the United States lost its innocence, and it certainly led to some good things, as sometimes the worst examples often do, of great reform on rules of engagement, great reform on law of war, and that sort of thing. And that's basically what happened at My Lai.
But, you know, let's talk about that and contrast that to the incident that happened, oh, I guess it's about 6 months ago now, in Afghanistan, where this young man went into a nearby village, apparently mm-hmm. there had been some deaths the night before, much in the same way as there had been some losses, I guess, in the night before, the days before, with in Callie's troop. And this young man some 6 months ago went in and slaughtered some civilians in Afghanistan. And he now is being defended by a civilian attorney who asserts that his defense is post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
So I sure would like your thoughts on that. Doug, what do you say to that?
You know, it's I'm sitting here because you get conflicted, and I can totally understand in the heat of battle when things are happening, when your friends have been killed around you, how you respond and everything else. So I understand, totally understand that, and I think anybody that's been in the military understands that. The horror about this stuff is you're making decisions instantaneously based on what you know, what you see, what's happening around you. You're responding to all events around you. And then the response that you, or decision that you make and the response that you give, which lasts maybe only a few minutes, then is dissected and discussed for weeks and months and years afterwards.
You know? It has consequences, doesn't it, Doug?
Yeah.
Well,
what do you think about that?
I guess I would say the first thing is that warfare for a long time, warfare is an act of state. So when you go in, you control it. That's the first and foremost thing, and that's what the non-commissioned officer and officer leadership is about. You control that primeval sense, and you just simply have to do that. The hounds of hell, I think it must be under control. And so what happens is when it gets out of control, then you have to do something about it. And this is not necessarily peculiar just to the military. The police have the same problem. Sometimes firemen do. What happens when someone steps over what their standard operating procedures can do? And in the incident in Afghanistan, obviously, you're going to have to determine the individual guilt or innocence of this person. But the problem is, of course, when you have someone who commits a criminal act like that, when he wears a uniform, the consequences are far greater than just the individual himself, because it involves the country, it involves the cause, it involves all sorts of things. And furthermore, it becomes even more complex, because it's not the normal crime scene. In that particular instance, you know, you don't have the police don't go in, they don't go around the chain of custody for evidence and all of that sort of thing. It's just in a war zone is a prosecutor's nightmare. So and in this particular instance, you just simply have to try those things out, as the military has done for a long time. I had the comparable case in Vietnam. It's it was written about later by Daniel Lang in a nonfiction novel style called Casualties of War. I think it's a movie, and Sean Penn was in it, and a whole bunch of things. But basically, it's a similar incident to the one Patricia that you described.
Mm-hmm.
In this particular instance, I defended. I didn't prosecute, and I suppose that may have been. It's a capital case, of course. And that was probably one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. But you do those things, and and we had a trial in the highlands of Vietnam with witnesses that included the person who performed the autopsy on President Kennedy, and a professor of anthropology from the University of Tokyo, and we hashed, put it to the jury, and got decisions, and so that's. What's going to have to be done in this particular instance?
And did their state of mind enter into it in either the Callie case or the case that you're talking about here, which, as I remember, involved the rape and murder of a young Vietnamese woman? Did the state of mind of the defendants enter into it? Did they assert PTSD, although that wasn't the term used back then, but where did the, in defending these men, did any of the attorneys assert that they had been under such extraordinary pressure and that the rules of engagement were lax and so forth and so on? Did any of that ever enter into it, their state of mind?
Well, the Congress of the United States, of course, is the one that, how should I say this, is in the best sense that I can say, is a soldiers' union. Mm-hmm. And it's the Constitution gives them the power to write the rules for how these sorts of things are done. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones that provide the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And I think it's fair to say that the Congress of the United States is not going to require soldiers to go into battle and to put their lives at risk and then treat them as second-class citizens. So that if they, in any of these sorts of trials, they have the same sort of mental defenses that they would have any place else. And the issue, of course, then becomes whether these sorts of things are recognized psychiatrically, whether they amount to an insanity defense, et cetera, if that's the case. But probably the most important thing when you talk about battlefield defenses like this is, again, when we talk about jury trials. I mean, if we're talking about Mila, I didn't want someone who was an accountant and had never smelled gunpowder or never had to step over bodies. I wanted someone who absolutely knew what was going on, because that's the sort of person who can make a decent value judgment on what conduct is appropriate or not appropriate under those sorts of extremist circumstances. And I think that's what that possibility, of course, exists in any of these sorts of cases.
I think one of the most interesting things today, and again, this is going back, Vietnam had some, but obviously Desert Storm and now Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom, we not only have the psychological domain where we have the psychological trauma, PTSD or combat stress, shell shock, whatever term you're going to put onto it. But the other thing what we've had from the complex toxic exposures, and look at the incredible, incredible medical diagnoses for the physiological problems. We know today that traumatic brain injury is not only a function of explosions and getting your brain rattled and everything else, where you have little physical damage to the brain where it now malfunctions, but the incredible toxic exposures are creating incredible problems medically all the way across. So along with the other thing where you have all this stuff acting, one of the things that we're seeing, because we're seeing it over and over here back in the States when they come back, the individual has not only the psychological manifestations, but they have the physiological manifestations, which result in sometime, and again, this is part of a defense or things that have come out with, the brain's not functioning right, and the soldier doesn't even know that it's not functioning right.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, I was, when I defended, I was always pleased that I had psychiatrists that I could at least reinforce or my unschooled judgment so that you could determine whether you needed to present such a defense and whether it was available and that sort of thing. But I would say what you just described on the dark side of the coin, Doug, is medical progress. When you talk about being able to know how those sorts of pressures affect the mind, one of the things, whether we like it or not, of war is that it allows the advances of medical science because of necessity. In Vietnam, for instance, I can still remember going to hospitals, and the doctors had all of these journals. There would be a row of tents, and they would have these journals out there, and they would have permanent ink, and they would spend hours a day writing in these particular journals. Now, what they were writing is that they were confronted with medical problems that they just simply, to be blunt, had to experiment with to try to save lives. And when they were, as they were so many times, thank heaven, successful, they tried to record what they had done so that we could later use that information, as we clearly have done in in trauma centers all over the United States in the years that follow, as you make advances in medical science, unfortunately brought on by the horror of war. But that what you're describing mentally, what you just described is mental, but the same thing has been true physically too, and I suspect we will learn a lot more about the brain in the next few years because of the traumas this country has been through in the past 10 plus years.
I think one of the things, and again we're seeing the same thing, but this goes back to antiquity. Anytime we go to war, obviously we're going to demonize the other side as much as possible.
And you have to be careful, Doug. The professional military person would tell you that you don't dare do that.
Well,
because the minute you say the other person is subhuman or doesn't have your capabilities, you cease to respect him as you should. And if you don't respect him as you should, he's more likely to kill you.
That might be true in theory. Bill,
but the good commanders that I know just wouldn't tolerate that.
I'm sorry to say, sir, that the good commanders that you know may well be far and few between, because as a veteran advocate, I can assure you that one of the principal ways that a man is able to ever get on that battlefield at all is to... If he starts to think, or she starts to think, and that'll be true too soon, that this is a person just like them, another human being, then they're not going to be as likely to fire upon them or as likely to kill them. So I guess there's a fine edge here, I guess is what I'm saying here.
Well, a professional soldier will tell you you certainly respect your adversary.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
And when we... go down the route that we often did, particularly in the Pacific in World War II and other times, that's racist and unhelpful. And it violates my theology, but I just think that's wrong.
Oh, I think you're right. But, you know, in the type of war that's being fought in Afghanistan and also in Iraq right now, we're talking about guerrilla warfare, essentially. And we're talking about what's called low-intensity warfare, where they go, where our soldiers go from host to house in Afghanistan and in Iraq. The contractors are doing this, and they're breaking into people's homes and ejecting the families and treating them rather brutally. So obviously here, those kinds of tactics lead to something, rules of engagement, that would in fact lead to the kind of conduct that we might find to be distasteful, that would be like the conduct that went on in Afghanistan or in My Lai.
Well, if you're in the type of warfare you're talking about, Patricia, you don't want them to do the things that you talked about.
I mean,
you may
obviously
have to. Or you may have to in specific times. One of the things that is particularly troublesome right now is that the most uniformly accepted international treaty deals with the Geneva Conventions. And how we treat people on the battlefield, et cetera. And that whole system is in absolute crisis because it depends upon two things. It depends upon reciprocity, the other side doing it, and it depends upon public pressure. And we are faced right now with battlefield instances where the people on the other side don't comply with any of those sorts of rules. And so what you're left with is basically the professionalism of the poor soldier on the other side who knows that you don't fight that way, and particularly if you represent a democracy, you stand for something and you behave yourself. But he does it and the other side doesn't. And every time he makes a slight mistake, he's criticized terribly. And when the other side cuts off heads and cuts off hands and does a whole bunch of things rather than treat people humanely, it's not much talked about. So it's hard. and it's going to get worse.
Well,
my point being, when you talk about the American service person who has to go in, that's the standard that they're expected to uphold, and I think they, for the most part, do a pretty darn good job considering what's going on around them.
Unfortunately, as the press is now in a position to be, quote, embedded in a battlefield scenario and is threatened with ejection if any member of the press should report on any kinds of misdeeds in the battlefield by American service people. We're not in a position to
They have
really
an obligation
know.
To prefer criminal charges if they think something like that's happened, Patricia. Let's be frank about it. They're not going to... I mean, the fact that Abraham Lincoln certainly didn't invite the press around. the openness that is current right now is really pretty astonishing, and I hope it continues.
I think that
helps the American soldier tell his story.
So
I think when
about,
we were in Vietnam, I mean, what we were doing there and when I was involved in there when I went over in March of 69 and basically stayed until June of 71, I mean, obviously I was involved in bombing with B-52s and maintenance and everything else, but we sure didn't want the media or the press or have any access to know what we were doing or what we were involved in. So, I mean, that was just a continuous thing. One thing that I found extraordinarily interesting is because I was directly involved at that time, they talked about bombing halts and the Christmas bombing halt and everything else. And, I mean, I've told the story before, and it's common knowledge, even flight records, that we were bombing on Christmas Day. You know, I personally was bombing on Christmas Day. You know, so all of this strikes you into this day. I mean, the veteran and the military guy, you have your orders that you have to do. You have to come back and understand what's involved. You have so-called enemy that you're going up against. You have the objectives that you're going for. You have the rules of engagement that you're coming from. And then you get put into this horrible nightmare.
The reality of war, yeah.
Yeah, where you have no control over anything that's happening. How you're going to respond at a given time is going to depend upon what's happened to you at that time, how you feel, what you think, what's happened to everybody around you. And then the commander, because I've been in all this thing from a sergeant to an executive officer, you do exactly what you say. And, I mean, the lessons we learn from Mili and what you've written before, Professor, is absolutely true to the date that we have attempted to update training and education and stuff and understanding to control everything. But then that horrible fog of war and the horrible reality of war seeps in.
The human condition.
I only think know of one way to deal with that, Doug. You know, when you're being shot at, you don't think quite as clearly as you normally do. I can assure you of that.
No kidding.
So what do we do about that? Well, you try to train for that. You have standard operating procedures. You go through certain drills. So what happens is when you're under that sort of pressure, if we've done the task of training correctly, you act like you were trained to act. And, of course, the whole purpose of the Mili prosecutions and everything else was when you cease to do that and you start doing something that you're not supposed to do, you need to intervene absolutely instantly and stop it. I mean, the whole purpose of the Mili prosecutions was to say to every single sergeant, every single captain, every single lieutenant colonel, and every single colonel, and indeed every single general, if things are not going as they're supposed to go on the battlefield, and you have the ability to do something about it, and you don't, I, as a prosecutor, am coming after you, or a prosecutor will come after you. It's the deterrence part, or the message that we don't stand for that, we don't deal that. That's the whole purpose of that. And so, what quickly followed after Mili, of course, was the educational processes. Unfortunately, I think we discovered that the rules of war had been left to the lawyers and left to the law library to collect dust. And you had to take it off and blow off the dust and make it incredibly practical and figure out how you're going to train and what you're going to do.
Before we sign off, and I don't know how much time we have here, but along these same lines, let me ask you, we had touched upon this very briefly the last time, and that was America's participation in treaties, war crime treaties. And you had said that you had been involved in some of those negotiations. And for the benefit of those who are not familiar with this, this is a treaty that has been signed on by a number of countries, but the United States has failed to sign on to a treaty that would, in fact, bring soldiers up on war crimes. So tell us about that.
Well, I think the first obligation of any country is to discipline their own soldiers. And that's the first, obviously, that's to go into effect even before that treaty does. But the treaty itself for the International Criminal Court is flawed because it leaves far too much discretion into one particular individual with no checks and balances anywhere. And the only thing I can tell you, and I don't think we have too much time, that it's the only time I have seen a treaty be opposed adamantly and throughout all the administrations by the Department of State, the Department of Defense, and the Department of Justice, primarily because it becomes a political tool to go against the United States of America, and that's what it was designed for in some ways, and that's what it was done. I think there are ways that if the prosecutorial decision to prosecute came through the Security Council or came through other than one individual, that might be a way to save it. I will tell you that the procedure when it was proposed, was awful. There was no way the United States could ever agree to it, even if we wanted to. And the current procedure was written by largely by the lawyers for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, so that if the United States ever changed its mind, it at least could live with some of the procedures that were there. I thought that I've spent entire weekends trying to figure out at Duke and other places where there was some way that things could change, and I finally decided that until there were a true change, particularly in who was a prosecutor, that idea would never fly in the United States, that's been the position of both Democratic and Republican administrations, and I suspect will continue to be.
The proposition of that, how does that vary from the Nuremberg trials?
Well, the proposition is that people will be punished and punished fairly. The issue is when you send American soldiers to do things, if they behave professionally, they're entitled to immunity. If they don't behave professionally, then we have a moral obligation to prosecute them ourselves and not have that done for political purposes.
I think the lesson
we tried to cooperate with them. And they misused the intelligence. It was just astonishing. They decided that for balance they needed to prosecute the United States and for certain things in the Balkans, for no reason, and that just sent red flags everywhere.
I think the important thing, I mean, when we tie in all this together and what you've spent your career at. And what you've been very clear here, the individual soldier has the ethical and moral obligations to comply with the rules of engagement, law of land warfare. The non-commissioned officer, the officer, has the total obligation to ensure proper training, proper education, proper equipment, proper medical care is given, and that everybody complies with all of these set, rules of engagement, laws of land warfare. Whether it's in the military or it's in law enforcement, it seems like it's across the whole domain because you pointed out very clearly tonight where we had heroes in the stuff there at the University of Mississippi took it upon themselves to say, this is what we have to do now. And obviously the same thing as what you'd had there when you're talking about Milai. You had the situation where you were involved where this is what happened, now this is what we have to do now. So it seems the lesson is what has happened gives us an indication of where we have human foibles and problems and everything to educate, train, and make a difference.
We talk about these horrible things not for self-flagellation. We just don't do that, do we, Doug? We do for exactly the reason you're articulating, so we can prevent in the future.
And that's a good way to close it, isn't it? Because we're coming up on closing. Thank you so much.
Professor, this is always an enjoyable, ladies and gentlemen, another incredible night of education, Progressive Renewed Radio Network, Warrior Connection, education and moving forward to make a difference in the world. Professor, thank you very much.
The pleasure was mine.
Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia. Ladies and gentlemen, have a good evening. God bless America.